Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, there are three potential buyers seeking to breathe new life into the South Philadelphia refinery complex. WHYY's Catalina Jaramillo will join us with more on what these buyers bring to the table. We'll also discuss the huge bonuses some executives walked away with as union employees were let go. We'll also catch up to jazz trumpeter Terrell Stafford. He is the new artistic director for jazz for the Philly Pops. But to start the hour, we're joined by Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Shapiro is suing the Sackler family, the founders and owners of Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma manufactures the opioid painkiller OxyContin, and the marketing and overprescription of OxyContin over the past two decades are widely blamed for fueling the opioid crisis in this country. Pennsylvania remains one of the state's hardest hit. We'll talk about Shapiro's suit against the Sacklers, which follows a multi-billion dollar settlement Purdue Pharma made with numerous other states. Pennsylvania did not sign on. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, send along an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at Radio Times, WHYY Radio Times, rather. Josh Shapiro, welcome back to Radio Times.
Good to be back, Mary. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with some backstory briefly. Purdue Pharma developed OxyContin as a 12-hour pain reliever in the 90s. The FDA signed off, I think it was right around 1995. But Josh, from the get-go, there were issues. Even as it was becoming apparent there was an addictive nature to this medication, Purdue Pharma was marketing it as a pill that was safer and less addictive than other opioids. Do I have that correct?
You do. And what Purdue Pharma did was they made, and we allege this in our complaint against Purdue, 500,000 sales visits here in Pennsylvania. We were second only to California in the number of sales visits that Purdue representatives made to doctors' offices. They lied to doctors about the addictive nature of these pills. They lied to patients. They targeted doctors with suspicious prescribing activities. And they specifically targeted our seniors in Pennsylvania and our veterans in Pennsylvania to try and push these medications out onto them. And as a result of that, millions and millions of people across this country, as a result of that behavior, and here in Pennsylvania, got addicted to OxyContin, which, by the way, has the exact same chemical makeup as heroin. And from that addiction, people migrated to heroin. And today we're seeing the effects of that conduct. We lose 12 Pennsylvanians every single day to opioids and to opioid overdoses. And that is not something that I'm on the stand for. And we're going to hold everybody accountable, drug dealers, doctors, and pharmaceutical executives.
Josh Shapiro, you say Purdue Pharma cost Pennsylvania how many billions of dollars?
Well, we know that Purdue Pharma made $35 billion here in Pennsylvania as a result of these sales. And we also know that as a result, we've got tens of billions of dollars in cost to the Commonwealth in drug treatment, in lost wages, lost opportunities. And I'm going to do everything in my power to recover from Purdue Pharmaceutical, from the Sackler family who own and operate Purdue, along with the other manufacturers and distributors of opioids.
The Sackler family has become astronomically wealthy. How much are they worth?
Well, we estimate that the Sackler's net worth is between $13 and $14 billion. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand how this company operated, because it's really different than most companies. Every time the company would make a dollar, the Sackler family, which own and operate it, would suck most of that dollar out, you know, after expenses and what have you, and put it into trust funds, put it into offshore accounts. But most importantly, they were putting it into their pocket. And what they're now trying to do is shield those ill-gotten gains from me and others who want to hold them accountable. We're not going to let them get away with that. And we are going to dig into their billionaire pockets and recover for the people of Pennsylvania.
How much do you want to recover?
A heck of a lot more than what they're proposing in this so-called settlement. This settlement, understand, and I think it's important to talk a little bit about that, because
sure,
it is, you know, clearly misunderstood, and there's a lot of misinformation that's been put out there by the Sacklers. First and foremost, the Sacklers and Purdue have said this is worth $10 to $12 billion. It's simply not. That's nonsense. The Sacklers are only willing to commit $3 billion for the entire country. But understand, they're not digging into their pockets for that. That money is coming from selling their companies and from state attorneys general agreeing to let Purdue and its subsidiaries overseas continue to sell opioids in order to generate the revenue to pay off the states. Hmm. That to me is just unacceptable. So, A, they're wrong on the amount of money. They're dramatically overstating it. B, the entire, you know, quote unquote settlement is predicated upon their ability to continue to sell opioids. And C, they're not accepting responsibility for their conduct here. And the deal lacks transparency. And that's why I've sued them here in Pennsylvania in Commonwealth Court, both Purdue as well as the Sackler family, because I want to hold them accountable here in Pennsylvania for the damage they've inflicted upon people here.
Are you optimistic Pennsylvania will prevail? And if so, where does that money go?
Well, I'm hopeful that we will prevail. Obviously, with them declaring bankruptcy, they're trying very hard to shield themselves.
Sure. And
they're doing everything they can to run away from their responsibilities. I mean, I think really that's the story of this bankruptcy, that it's another sign the Sacklers are just running away from their responsibilities. We know they've moved the value out of Purdue Pharma. So declaring bankruptcy for Purdue Pharma is not the real story. The real issue is, where did those ill-gotten gains go? Where are those offshore accounts, and how do we get access to them? How do we make sure Pennsylvania gets its fair share? And as far as your other question about what to do with that money, 100%, 100 cents on the dollar of that money that we recover should go into treatment and care for those who are in need. That's where that money should go, and that's where, you know, whatever I agree to ultimately is going to be stipulated upon the fact that the money goes to help those people in need.
Let's talk briefly again about the tentative settlement, which was reached last week with about, I think, two dozen state attorneys general and thousands of municipalities and counties. You know, why did talks break down with some states, including Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro?
Well, I've been at the table as one of the four leading states out of 48 states involved in this, and it's bipartisan. Two Democratic attorneys general, two Republican attorneys general. We've worked, I think, incredibly well together, and we've worked with all of the different companies involved, not just Purdue, though I recognize right now you and I are primarily talking about Purdue.
Yeah.
I walked away from the table when it became clear that Purdue was not serious and the Sacklers were unwilling to give up those ill-gotten gains and pay for the damage that they inflicted. They, frankly, they just weren't serious. And so I felt that it was time to file suit, which is why we filed suit against Purdue back in May and against the Sacklers personally last week.
We are speaking with Josh Shapiro, Attorney General for the state of Pennsylvania. We've got some comments coming in, so let's get to them. Email from Cynthia. It's good to see these pharmaceutical companies finally being held accountable for their role in this opioid crisis. I work for a large orthopedic hospital in Pennsylvania and have seen doctors writing prescriptions for opioids like it's candy. They all are profiting from this, and it's time for them to pay. Josh, any thoughts on Cynthia's comment?
Thank you, Cynthia, for your comment. And you're spot on. And I agree with you that not only do pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical executives need to pay, the doctors do as well, which is why when I took office about 2.5 years ago, we put new emphasis and hired new people and put a new focus on what's called diversion. That's where doctors, nurses, healthcare providers actually divert legal prescription drugs for illegal use. As a result of our efforts, what we have seen is a 50% increase in diversion arrests. That's, you know, pill mill docs and others who are taking what is otherwise a legal product and using it for illegal purposes. And we're seeing the effect of all that. This combination of pharmaceutical company executive greed, this combination of doctors acting wrongly, and of course, drug dealers on our street corners. Because now we're seeing the effects. The opioid crisis is the number one killer in Pennsylvania. It kills 12 Pennsylvanians every single day, 200 people every day across the United States. And what I could tell you from my travels all across the Commonwealth, I've been to all 67 counties many times, this killer doesn't discriminate.
Yeah.
You know, black, white, brown, rich, poor, male, female, young, old, urban, suburban, rural. It hits everyone. You know, and two out of three Pennsylvanians know someone personally. who suffered from addiction.
Interesting. I'm so sorry. Go ahead. Finish your thought, Josh.
Something needs to stop. And I would just say, because I think a lot of people get confused about, well, what are the prescription drugs have to do with the heroin crisis that we're seeing in Kensington and across Pennsylvania? 4 out of every 5 heroin and fentanyl users start by abusing prescription drugs. Because remember, the chemical makeup is nearly identical. But when you go and try to buy a prescription drug illegally, you could be spending sometimes $20, $30 for a pill. Yet you can go buy a bag of heroin on the streets of Pennsylvania today for a shocking 77 cents. Yeah. 77 cents. And so there's this migration from these pills, which people are getting addicted to fentanyl and heroin, which you're buying on the street. That's how this all gets wrapped together. And why, as Cynthia pointed out, you've got to hold doctors accountable, you've got to hold the pharmaceutical companies accountable, and you got to hold the drug dealers accountable, and we're doing all three.
We have a tweet from Banker Dude who asks, can the Attorney General talk about action against the other manufacturers that produced more pills than Purdue? And, of course, we've got some of them, I think, headquartered in our area. We've got Endo, we've got Teva. Briefly, we could use probably a whole hour on this, Josh, but we just have a couple of minutes.
Sure. Well, I would just tell Banker Dude that I announced last year that we were targeting 6 manufacturers, including some of those that you mentioned, and Purdue, and 3 manufacturers. And they're responsible for more than 95% of our nation's opioid sales and distribution. No one's off limits. Just because I'm not talking about a specific investigation doesn't mean that we're not in high gear on it. And I can assure Banker Dude and everybody else we're in high gear when it comes to holding these manufacturers and distributors accountable.
Email from Kyle. Could an attorney general use civil forfeiture as another option to get all the ill-gotten gains? Interesting question.
It is. And we've got a lot of tools at our disposal, both civil and criminal. And we are using all of the tools we have available. And I realize it's a little challenging for me to talk about all the different work we're doing because of confidentiality, of course. But I can just assure your listeners that this is my number one priority. It's our biggest public safety threat. It's our biggest public health threat. And we are using all of the tools in our toolbox to hold everybody accountable.
One more quick question, Josh. Do you think settlements worth billions, the dissolution of Purdue Pharma, the Sackler family contributing billions, will this help to promote a sense of accountability among corporate giants in developing and promoting new products? Do you think there's a lesson here?
I think there is a lesson if the right terms are reached. I don't think that there is a lesson if we allow the Sacklers and Purdue to have their cake and eat it, too. We can't allow the Sacklers and Purdue to set all the terms, right? We can't allow them to keep all their ill-gotten gains, because that actually sends a clear message that you can use the laws of this country, our bankruptcy laws, and you can, you know, use the power of your extraordinary wealth to push people around. That's not the way it should work in the United States of America, and that's not the way I want to let it work here in Pennsylvania. We're going to hold these powerful people accountable. We're going to recover for the people of Pennsylvania, and this is one part of our broader efforts to deal with this opioid crisis we're facing.
All right,
we
Josh.
We should not allow the Sacklers to get away with it, and I won't.
Unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for joining us, Josh Shapiro, State Attorney General for Pennsylvania. Stay with us. Radio Times continues in just a moment.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We now turn to the fate of the South Philadelphia refinery complex. Since the explosion and fire of June 21st and the subsequent shuttering of the Philadelphia Energy Solutions plant, over 1,000 union employees have found themselves out of work with no severance pay or extended medical benefits, or very little, while company executives have walked away with millions in bonuses. And there remains the question of what will happen to the complex itself. At last word, there are 3 potential buyers, but no definitive deal in the offering as yet. Also, major environmental concerns persist at the site, which could impact negotiations. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. WHYY's Catalina Jaramillo has been following this story, and she joins us now in studio with the latest. Hi, Catalina.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Great, thanks. So one of the stories you filed last week opens like this. Infuriating. unfair, repulsive. Those were some of the printable words used by former employees of PES. And Catalina, this was following news that company executives had walked away with from a devastating situation with some extraordinary bonuses. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this was, we found out this because of the companies in bankruptcy proceedings, and this was papers that were filed in the court Friday night last week. So I went to one of the refinery meetings that we're going to talk later. The city's in this process of meeting with all the stakeholders. And I met there with the union members, former union members, because most of them don't have their jobs anymore. And they were very disgusted and mad about the executives having $4.5 million in bonuses. Some of them haven't worked there like more than a year. And this is people who have been working there for like some of them for like generations in this refinery. So they felt this was very unfair.
And again, with the timeline, as you report, the bonuses were paid July 5th. This was exactly 2 weeks after the explosion and fire and just weeks before the company filed for Chapter 11. So on the face of it, it might seem like a, you know, cut your losses and run situation for these executives. Catalina, are there investigations into whether there was anything illegal about the timing of these bonuses?
Not that I'm aware of. What I know is that this kind of retention bonuses, they're called, are common, are part of the bankruptcy proceedings or process. They are used to actually retain some of these executives that are supposedly in a very risky job because they can lose at any time. But what is common is that they do this when they are in the proceedings, while the bankruptcy court is in the process.
Not before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Having this before is not common. And what I hear is that this might be looked at by the judge in the bankruptcy court. And something might happen, but
so perhaps there might be some recourse for the union here.
That's what I've been reading. Some experts in bankruptcy have said that.
Yeah. So over 1,000 employees lost their jobs with, if I'm correct, no severance pay or extended medical benefits after working at the refinery for years. What sort of financial support did they get?
So some of them got 2 weeks paid after being fired, and then 83 of them were kept. So that was kind of like the negotiation that the union did. They felt it was very important that some employees stayed at the refinery.
Yeah,
the
union said it could be dangerous if, if people weren't there, who didn't know what they were doing. Yeah.
Exactly. This is like, there are complex jobs, and this is, they're dealing with toxics, they're dealing with things that are dangerous. So they thought it was very important that some of the experts who know what's going on stayed at the refinery and kept all this process of kind of like closing the refinery or keep it going in a safely mode. They also think this is very important because they want someone to buy the refinery and to keep the refinery working as a refinery. So if you stop operating at all, like totally, then to start it all over takes more work, takes more money to invest if someone buys it. So if they keep this kind of like 83, they're called caretakers, the kind of like trespass to a new potential buyer, it's more seamless.
We're going to get to the buyers who are waiting in the wings in just a few moments, but just a couple more questions about the folks who were laid off. Some were not able to access their pensions?
Yeah, the union leaders have told me that, and some of the union workers also, there's a option for them to access their retirement through cash, through a cash option, and they haven't been able to do that. So some of them who have been, say, like they haven't been able to find a job, or they have to move, they want to sell their house, or they want cash for any reason, they haven't been able to take that cash.
We are speaking with Catalina Jaramillo, a reporter for Plan Philly, right here at WHYY. Any response from Philadelphia Energy Solutions regarding the bonuses and the situation regarding the union members?
Not really. It's, I mean, the company is barely kind of like functioning. The press person that we deal with, it's no longer there. We still contact them anytime we're doing a story, but I haven't got any response. And even the website, last time I checked, the website was not working.
There are now three potential buyers. When we last spoke, three. Right. What did they bring to the table?
Well, one of them, many of you might remind him, is Phil Rinaldi.
So he was the former CEO of Philadelphia Energy Solutions.
Right. He started this company.
Got it. Okay.
And then he left. And then the people who is in charge now came. And now, like, I interview him. One of the things he told me that was kind of endearing is he said, like, I see the refinery now, I feel the refinery as my child, and now I see it like kind of like in the floor with his nose bleeding, and I need to kind of like come to the rescue. So that's one of the things that he's feeling. He created another company called Philadelphia Energy Industries, and his plan is to keep the refinery going as a refinery, adapt to what the market needs now, do more petrochemicals, he said. He said, I'm not going to reveal my model.
Okay.
But he said he was going to keep that. And he's also renting the space to another renewable energy company, which also had this deal with PS before. It was in the process. I reported that kind of like partnership a year ago. So now that partnership could keep going if Phil Rinaldi gets the refinery.
How has the union reacted to the news that Rinaldi might be back in the picture?
They're happy. I mean, they at least my main contact is Ryan O'Callaghan, who used to be the president of the union. Now he's unemployed, so he's the speaker of the union. But he said, like, we like him, we trust him, we've worked with him. He wants to keep the refinery going as a refinery, so that's something that they want. Even though, like, it's very improbable for some of these same employers to be working at that refinery in the future, because, like, there's going to be a long time between this new refinery starts going. So these employees are not going to stay in their house kind of, like, waiting for these jobs to come. Like, most of them already have new jobs. Others are looking. They're, like, trying to move somewhere else.
What about an entity which would be focused on renewable energy? There was great interest in this among, of course, environmental groups and others in the city because this plant, I think it's been around for, 150 years? It's been a major polluter the entire time it's been sitting there.
Yeah, there's a lot, like a lot of people would like that and not to have fossil fuels. So Phil Rinaldi's option includes this renewable energy other company. So, and he wants to, this other company, sorry, wants to do solar and biofuels. Then there's a second interested potential buyer, CG Preston.
Okay.
It's a company based in Philadelphia. They haven't actually done anything. They don't have anything, any plant like this functioning, but they have plans to building one. And I haven't been able to reach them. I've called them and other media has also been trying to reach them and there's no response. So it's not very clear how serious this kind of like project would be, but it is a biofuel project also. We don't know what part of this 1,400 acres would this project would take place in.
But so it might not encompass the whole complex.
No, like the thing is, like all these potential buyers, we don't know a lot because they would have to go through the bankruptcy proceedings,
right.
And that has not happened yet. This is things that media has heard or like you know tips. Phil Rinaldi, in his case, he sent a press release. But most of these are things we're hearing.
And so I guess since it's all seemingly up in the air, the Kenney administration probably hasn't tipped its hand yet as to what it might favor, which proposal, if there is even a solid proposal, it might favor.
Yeah, no, they're not commenting at all. All of the potential buyers are meeting with the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation, which is kind of like helping the city navigate this process with their expertise. So they have met with all the potential buyers, but they're not commenting at all on the process.
So let's talk a little bit about the Philadelphia Refinery Advisory Group, what members are trying to accomplish. And also, I'm assuming the community, members of the community go to these meetings too, right, Catalina?
Totally.
What are you hearing from them, especially regarding, obviously, the you know, employment situation, but also environmental concerns, ongoing environmental concerns at the plant and, you know, about cleanup as well?
Okay. I'll start kind of like saying a little bit about the advisory group.
Okay.
So this is a group that the city created as soon as the fire happened. And it was like the interest of the city was to gather all the stakeholders, all the people interested in this, and kind of like hearing what do people want with this place. Now, they're very cautious in saying that the city has very limited power to actually what happens with this site because they don't own this site.
Yeah.
So they cannot tell them what to do. They can tell them to follow the regulations, but they cannot tell them what to do. So this is a private property. But they still want to gather all the information from different parts of the community. So the advisory group has four committees. There is the environmental committee, the business committee, the environmental committee, business committee, and community. So we've been having all these meetings, and you mostly hear these two things, right? What you said, jobs and environment. So basically, the union members and the refinery workers want this to remain a refinery, and they kind of like underline how important it is for the economy. And then the other side, environmentalists, academics, and the community mostly don't want the refinery to decide to continue being a refinery.
Yeah.
And they would prefer uses that are more in tune with what we know now about climate change or uses that would benefit the city.
But this is zoned industrial, right? So you're not going to see, I'm guessing, parks and new houses go up at this site.
Right. And that's the challenge. As I said, the city doesn't own this property. So there's not a lot of what the city cannot just say, oh, we're going to do a park. And even like if they wanted that, Brian Abernathy, who co-chairs the advisory group.
The managing director.
In Radio Times, he said, like, this is not going to be a park. This is not going to be a green area because this has been a refinery for 150 years, and the amount of pollution that it's in that zone, like in the soil, in the groundwater, and the surface water is so big. There's so much pollution.
And the cleanup has been ongoing for decades.
The cleanup process started in one way or another in 1993. So it's been years, and it's supposed to finish in December 2020, but we already know that it's going to have to be extended because there's a lot of other complications that we can talk about of what happens now with that cleanup process.
Realistically, though, back to the community, I mean, it's an advisory group, the Philadelphia Refinery Advisory Group. I mean, how much of a voice at the end of the day will people in the neighborhoods who live near the refinery complex have?
That is the big, big, big question that everyone is having, everyone that goes there. And I have to say, like, it has been so interesting, this process. All these meetings have been pretty well attended. Members from different parts of the community go and say what they want or give their advice in this like 3-minute comment period. There also have been presentations from part of the city and from part of experts. And yeah, the big question at the end of the day is like, okay, what is this? Is this just like a venting session? Is it going to have the community is saying like, we've spent so much time in this process. Like, are you making us lose our time? And or are we going to have any say in this? Because again, like every meeting is started with this statement of the city doesn't have a lot of power. But at the same time, I feel like experts and community members have told me that it is important to have this instance. It is important for them to have the city hearing all this, to have the city gathering like environmental and health experts saying like what would be appropriate to do with this site, or community saying like what would they want.
And hopefully that will be used to shape the future of the site moving forward.
I mean, technically, all this process ends up in a report that the city is going to publish sometime in the fall. They haven't said a date. But yeah, this all ends up in a report with all, they say these are not recommendations, but with all this information gathered in the process.
Do we know, Catalina, how much the ongoing cleanup efforts and what's projected down past 2020 as far as cleanup is concerned, how this might all affect a potential sale?
I don't think, I mean, there is one case where it affects. So let me go back a little bit. The cleanup process, as I said, started in 1993. Then it kind of like reshaped in 2002. And this was all undertaken by Sunoco, which was the previous owner.
Yeah.
In 2012, Sunoco sells the refinery to PES. And in their buy-in agreement, they established that all the pollution before that year is responsibility of Sunoco.
Okay.
Which is what is going on. This is the process that the cleanup process that ends up in December 2020. Sunoco is responsible for all the legacy pollution of that site until 2020. Then PES is responsible for any pollution happening from 2012 to now.
So we only have about, I guess, 15, 20 seconds left. So really, the companies, we would assume that the three potential buyers who are out there are aware of this and know that they're going to have to somehow, you know, at least be part of that effort moving forward.
They're not responsible for anything before they buy.
But they're going to have to deal with it.
But, and here's the complication that if we have time, we can talk about this, but we don't. Okay, so basically the cleanup process is for an industrial use. So if it's not a refinery, they buy it, they have to clean it to a higher standard.
Okay. Catalina, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Catalina Jaramillo is reporter for Plan Philly at WHYY. I'm sure we'll be talking about this story some more as it unfolds. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we'll have jazz trumpet player Terrell Stafford. He is now artistic director of jazz at the Philly Pops. Keep it here.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Terrell Stafford's Carolyn from his 2015 album Brotherly Love. We have just a little bit of a taste of that. We are happy to welcome Terrell back to Radio Times. He is a Grammy Award-winning jazz trumpet player and founder of the Jazz Orchestra of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Stafford is also director of jazz studies at Temple University and chair of instrumental studies at Temple. And earlier this year, Terrell was designated artistic director for jazz for the Philly Pops. So nice to have you back in studio with us, Terrell Stafford.
Great to be back. Thank you, Mary.
And congratulations on the new gig.
Thank you.
So what does the job of artistic director for jazz at the Philly Pops entail? How's it going?
Well, it's great. Basically, what happened is the Philly Pops saved us in that the jazz orchestra was going on, and my wife and I were the ones that were pretty much writing grants for it and keeping it alive. And now with a 2.5-year-old, it's been more difficult to do that. And the Philly Pops came along and said, hey, look, we love what you're doing. How about we provide an infrastructure for the group? And if you'll become our artistic director for jazz, we can keep that group going. And it's been great. So we'll continue our fall concert, doing the music of the Nutcracker, Strayhorn, Ellington piece. And that will be in December, and we have a concert in May that will be with an outstanding vocalist, Cecile McLaurin-Savant. And so this collaboration with the Pops is what it's basically going to do is continue to provide jazz and provide this place for musicians of Philadelphia to come and perform together, of course. But it's also going to have us and allow us to bring in bigger name artists so that we can bring different folks and have different kind of projects to do, not only with the big band, but maybe even with the big band and orchestra. So it's really exciting.
Terrell, who's on your wish list?
Diane Reeves is one person on my wish list. Mm-hmm. Cassandra Wilson, I love her. And this particular concert we have in December is going to be Randy Brecker and Jeff Hamilton, two of my heroes. Randy Brecker has been, of course, from Philadelphia, trumpeter, and he is the greatest. So it's going to be great to have him coming up in our December concert.
So for those of us who've kind of skirted around jazz as a musical genre, maybe, you know, flirted with it, what's the best way for us to become familiar with it and even to fall in love with it?
Well, you know, jazz is very complex in a way because that word covers so many different genres, so to speak. But I think, and the thing that can turn us off to jazz is just not really knowing what it's about. So I always, when I meet people and they're like, so what's a good jazz thing for me to check out just to, you know, to wet my palate? I always refer to the record Kind of Blue. You know, Miles Davis, it was the top-selling jazz record. And there's something on that record for everyone. And the way Miles Davis approaches music is from a melodic point of view. The thing that can turn folks off, or even turning me off at the beginning, because I wasn't a huge fan of jazz when I started to play the trumpet. I just wanted to play classical trumpet. And then when I heard Miles Davis play, something in me changed because I could relate to what he was playing, and it was tangible, you know. And because of that, I started to really enjoy it. And when I would listen to it, I would listen to different versions of the same tune and say, this is remarkable. He can play one tune and it can sound so different every time he played it. And so that's how I got started, and that's how I recommend other people get started. And once you understand it, then you want to go deeper and deeper and figure out what people are thinking and how people are creating on the spot, because that's what really makes jazz unique, the improvisation.
Yeah.
Spontaneous creativity is what makes it really unique.
Tarell, when you improvise, do you have a loose game plan going into a performance, or is it strictly of the moment? And if it's strictly of the moment, what are the risks?
Well, I think all of us have a game plan, because when you step into a performance, you want to be prepared. But for jazz, which is really different in some ways than classical music, when I would play more classical music, my performance would be very repetitive on how I prepare certain phrases and certain difficult passages. For jazz, it's the same thing. But then when it comes to improvising, I want to make sure I have comfort in the chord changes that I need to play over. Comfort in that when I get to the performance, I want to be able to express or sing, you know, through my instrument. And if I can sing through my instrument, then I'm being as honest and clear as a musician as possible. When I'm not singing through my instrument, then blops and blips could happen. So that's what I want to do. I want to make sure that I'm comfortable enough to sing over it. And, you know, the example I give to some students and to some folks is like, if you want to figure out, you know, what improvisation feels like, the next time you sing Happy Birthday, add a few more, you know, passages or turns to Happy Birthday and see if you can create melodies over Happy Birthday, because it's something that's really familiar.
Sure.
And then it's, as you tend to add to that and create different little, you know, lines to Happy Birthday, that in a way is what every jazz musician does when they improvise. So I want to be prepared to do the best, but I also want to leave that spontaneity there.
Well, let's talk about another musical group you lead, the All City Jazz Orchestra, which is a partnership between the School District of Philadelphia and the Pops. You're director of this. Mm-hmm. So is this something you do with the young people you work with? I mean, do we hear different versions of Happy Birthday?
You know what? Happy Birthday to me is something that made improvisation really tangible, in that when I first heard jazz, when I was in graduate school, is when I first started to play jazz. It was so complex. I'd listen to people play and I'd hear all these notes. And when I conduct the All City Band, I see these kids coming in and they're excited about it. But the examples they like to listen to are really complex examples. And they're like, well, I really wanted to learn this song, but it's so hard. And what we don't realize is that it's difficult for anyone. You know, if you're a level one improviser, you should find a level one solo to learn, not a level 10 solo. So when I come to meet with these students, those who don't feel comfortable improvising, we keep things as simple as possible. Those who feel more comfortable, then we can give them a more of a challenge to say, okay, let's attack a level 6 solo or maybe a level 7 solo. But those that are new to it and are excited about it but have just been intimidated by it, we find a level 1 solo and we introduce that solo and they sing the solo and they learn the solo, or they play Happy Birthday and I say, play some embellishments on Happy Birthday.
Do you do that in concert at all?
Oh, I don't do it in concert so much. I could, though.
It was somebody's birthday, right?
That's right. That's right.
These are middle and high schoolers, right?
These are high school students.
High schoolers. Yeah. And mm-hmm. they come from across the city?
Yes.
How do you know if a young person has the it factor? You know, or is there such a thing as the it factor? Is it really just a great performance is the result of a lot of hard work?
There is an it factor. There's some that you can just tell things come easier for them than others. But, you know, what I found in this business is that it's all about hard work. And if you have a great work ethic and that's something that's instilled at a young age, then you'll find success in anything, whether it's music or whether it's, you know, I was just speaking outside the door about how much I admire you because there's so many topics that you know about. I just think it's great how you can just expound on things.
So, there's a lot of studying that goes on behind the scenes.
Well, we have that in
otherwise
common.
Otherwise it wouldn't happen, yeah.
Exactly. So in order to play this music at the level, you know, that, you know, we want these students to play it, there's a lot of studying involved and a lot of dedication.
What's it like working with teens and people who are just starting to figure themselves out?
You know, it's a beautiful thing because it takes you back to when you were at that point in life and what did you need at that point in life? And that's what I want to provide for them. If they may need an example to say, hey, what can I listen to be better? Or they could just need someone to talk to and say, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to prepare for an audition. Auditions make me nervous. How do I get over nerves? That's the huge, you know. So to speak with someone about preparation, how do we prepare? How do we develop a routine that you can go through each day to help you prepare to be a better auditioner or to be a better improviser or be a better sight reader or to be a better section player? So these are the kind of things that we want to instill in the students. And what happens is at the end of the year, we're family, it's community. And that's really what's important. That's what this music is about.
Switching gears for just a moment, the Jazz Orchestra of Philadelphia, I think, is also in May going to be at the Kimmel Center with a tribute to Frank Sinatra. You are a Sinatra fan?
I am a Sinatra fan. We're going to be doing, actually in May, it's going to be Cecile McLaurin Savant, but we did a tribute to Sinatra in his centennial year. And what we did is at Temple, actually, we combined for the first time. We combined the orchestra and the jazz band, and we asked my colleague Dick Oates came together, and this great arranger Michael Abeni put together some beautiful songs, and we recorded it.
Well, we have we'd like to play a little bit of "Luck Be a Lady" right now, featuring you, Terrell, on trumpet and the Temple University Studio Orchestra.
Yep.
Okay, let's go. Luck Be a Lady,
yes.
Featuring Terrell Stafford on trumpet and the Temple University Studio Orchestra. What goes through your mind when you hear that?
Well, a lot of emotions go through my mind and my heart. You know, it's one thing to be a professional musician and travel around the world and play with other professional musicians, but it's another thing to perform with your students. And it's an amazing feeling. When I was in...
Why? How so?
So you spend 4 years preparing students, sometimes five, whatever it takes to prepare a student to perform. And the only way that you can find out if they're at the level they need to be is to be performing with them. And if they are, then the music is great and feels great. If they aren't, then the music doesn't feel great and it's not so great. So the opportunity to perform with them is a beautiful thing. It's a testament, I think, to the hard work of all the faculty at Temple University. And it gives the students the opportunity to perform with their fellow colleagues. Some of the orchestra folks may not have the opportunity to perform with the jazz band. So bringing those two worlds together and then allowing the opportunity to record, which is in itself a skill that, you know, it takes many years to acquire. How do you go into a studio and play one take and have it be perfect and not have to play 20 takes and have it, you know, so there's focus, there's concentration, there's preparation again and a lot of studying. And I think it's an important thing, it's an important skill for the students to have and come away with.
What does it take to play the trumpet well?
I think it takes a discipline. For me personally, I've devised, I'm a very routine-oriented person, so I have a maintenance routine that I do. I have a growth routine, and I have an exploration routine. And the routine that never, whether it's vacation or otherwise, is my maintenance routine. It's never left out. I take my trumpet everywhere. So I feel like I always have to maintain what I do. And then if I'm not on vacation, I'm home, then it's all about my growth. And how do I grow? I have to be honest with myself every day I practice. And then outside of my growth, then I want to explore. I want to figure out ways to write. I want to figure out ways to create, to study harmonies, to study melody, to study rhythm. And that's my exploration part. So all those three together help me to be the best trumpeter I can be.
You've been nominated for numerous Grammy Awards and won as a member of the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra for the album Monday Night Live at the Village Vanguard. But what's it like to be on the receiving end of such a huge award?
You know, it's really, really special in a way because, you know, as a musician, that's the pinnacle. You know, can I get a Grammy? Will I ever be on a Grammy record? And I've been nominated for plenty and some records that I thought that would, you know, actually get the award. But when we did the CD live Monday night with the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, at least for me, my focus wasn't on a Grammy. My focus was just to play at the highest level I could. And then one day we get the call, you know, like, we won the Grammy. And it was great. And it was 16, you know, 16 of us in the band. And have 16 people celebrate the hard work that we put into playing the music at the highest level we could meant a lot.
I think that can only help in furthering your career.
That's right.
I don't know if this is the latest info about you, but your most recent album was Family Feeling, released last year.
Yeah.
Are you spending time in the recording studio these days with more something to be released ahead?
Yes. The Family Feeling was a faculty CD that we did, and that was something that my dean requested. He really wanted the faculty, which he feels is outstanding at Temple, and I feel the same way since I'm the director of the program. And we put the CD together, and it was magical. Our composition professor, Bruce Barth, who's also a pianist, wrote the music, and he brought it in, and we re-recorded it, and it was just like a big family reunion. And we have a new CD coming out, another studio orchestra CD. The music was written by Vince Mendoza and myself and my colleague Dick Oates performed on that as well. So I'm hoping the next thing that is going to be coming out is a jazz orchestra, you know, Philadelphia, the Jazz Orchestra of Philadelphia CD. And we've had some exciting guests, and that would be that's my on my bucket list, that, you know, my wish list. I want to get that CD out, and some of our guests that have appeared with the orchestra have them on the CD, like people like Jimmy Heath and Benny Golson, who are just huge names in Philadelphia and have done so much for jazz. So
we'll watch for it.
Watch for it.
Very quickly, Terrell, you are dad to a young daughter. Any hints of musical talent there?
Well, just yesterday, she loves to buzz my mouthpiece, and she loves to play my trumpet, and she gets a pretty good sound. So I think there could
Stay
be
tuned.
A little trumpeter.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. It was such a pleasure.
My pleasure.
We
Thank
are
you,
now
Mary.
Listening to Soft Winds yep. from Terrell Stafford's 2003 album, New Beginnings. What a pleasure. Thanks so much for
my
being
pleasure.
Here.
My pleasure. Thank
you. Terrell Stafford is the new artistic director for jazz for the Philly Pops. And as always, if you get the chance, check us out on social media. There's also a terrific collection of Radio Times podcasts. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for the Radio Times Regional Roundup.